From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 1-800-NOW-OPEN or open.com.
Catherine Lamper sitting in for Leonard Lopate today here on WNYC AM, FM, and WNYC.org. Andy Summers was already an established guitarist in Britain in 1977 when he was invited to join an American drummer named Stuart Copeland and another fellow Brit, a bass player and vocalist who went by the moniker of Sting. Their band, The Police, filled stadiums with fans and with such songs as Message in a Bottle, Roxanne, and Every Breath You Take. The group broke up in 1983. But Andy Summers never stopped making music or pursuing his love of jazz and classical guitar. Guitarist Pat Metheny has called him one of the best guitarists in the world. What's it like to live out the fantasy of becoming a rock god? Andy Summers tells us in a new memoir that has been called Disarmingly Literary. He's here in the studio to talk about life before, during, and after The Police in his book, One Train Later. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Best guitarist in the world. You hadn't heard that?
Wow, I'm very pleased to hear it from Pat Metheny, who I did jam with a few times back in that era. So now, anyway, yeah, great.
So you said once in an interview that this book was about 20 years too late. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, I said that, well, you know, it's just one of those things I sort of not kept putting off but didn't get around to. And as I've mentioned a couple of times already, like, you know, a lot of people say the classic way they phrase it so far is, why this book? Why now?
You know, okay. Do you want me to try that? Hang on a minute. Why this book? Yeah. And why now?
Yes. Thank you very much.
My
standard response is, well, you know, it was... You know, it's not really this book and it's not really now. It's, I didn't feel the need to necessarily document my own life and have some sort of narcissistic thrill by writing it out. I just thought I had something interesting to say and a lot of people would be interested in that. And the challenge for me was to write a book of this length, it was the creative challenge, really, I would say.
You write very winningly about your childhood in this book, and I was hoping you could talk just a little bit about when music first entered your life in a powerful way.
Certainly. I actually personally think the first half of the book is the more interesting because it's always the rise upwards and where it comes from that's more interesting than, because once you get there, of course, there's a plateau, and then what is it, you know? Hotel room, limo gig, you know, limo back to the hotel, and so on and so forth. I must have felt some inkling for music at, you know, probably around 5 or 6. Did have some piano lessons for a while, but I think there's a moment in the book that I really regard as a seminal moment that I write about, which is when I heard my music teacher at school playing Sophisticated Lady by Duke Ellington. And I heard this beautiful descending chromatic set of chords, 13th chords, and I asked him what it was, and he said it's called Sophisticated Lady by Duke Ellington, which meant absolutely nothing to me, but the music penetrated my soul. And that's, I think, when I realized there was something going on. And, you know, and I still didn't have a guitar yet, but I started taking an avid interest in listening to music on, well, in England at that time, it was Radio Luxembourg. You know, and a couple of years later, I got a guitar. And, of course, the minute it got in my hands, I was a guitarist. And there was never anything else for me.
Where did this all take place? Where did you grow up?
This actually in a town called Bournemouth in southwest England. It's a seaside resort, which has produced actually quite a number of famous musicians, oddly enough.
And what about that moment when you first got a guitar in your hand?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I necessarily went, this is it. Oh, my God. It was just like, I think I went very quiet and went off to my bedroom and started, like, playing around on this thing. You know, it was like this fantastic machine that was put in my hands. You know, I never put it down.
You used to go to a little store that sold jazz records.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about the influence that place had on you.
There was a huge, for me, the discovery of this jazz record store in my hometown, because I was flirting with jazz. Well, not even flirting. I was sort of interested in it, trying to figure out how you play these much more complex lines in the sort of surf tunes I'd been playing up to that point. And somebody told me there was a guy in town who had a fantastic record store. It's called Lenny's. And I found it eventually. I'd never seen it or heard of it before. And, of course, he had the motherload of all the American jazz albums. He was a total aficionado. And eventually he sort of took me under his wing and turned me on to a lot of great American jazz that, you know, I was too young and too naive to know about.
Now, for those of us who are music history civilians, can you explain what skiffle is?
Yeah, skiffle. Well, it was a music. I don't know if it was actually a term that originated in England, but it was a movement that came probably late 50s, very early 60s, with Lonnie Donegan, who had been a singer with the Chris Barber Jazz Band. But essentially, it was like singing songs like, you know, Rock Island Line and the Midnight Special, and John Henry was a still driving man. And the skiffle band was marked by using a washboard with thimbles, where you do this kind of scrubbing technique to create the rhythm. And then what they called a T-chest bass, which was an old T-chest sort of storage box made out of tea wood or something. And then you'd stick a broom handle out of it and attach a wire string to it. So it produced this sort of sonorous thump. That was skiffle. Yeah.
So here are all these boys in England singing about John Henry and the Rock Island Line.
You know, in a really weird way. Maybe it was a precursor of punk, because you could sort of do it without being able to do any music whatsoever. You get T-chest, bass, and washboard, you're a musician.
Now, of course, you didn't have just skiffle in your background. Before you joined the police, people who perhaps don't know, that they'd be surprised to learn you had, you know, a full resume by then.
Yeah, I mean, I had done quite a bit by the time I was in the police. You know, I played through a lot of music. I'd been to university, studied, you know, classical music, played classical guitar. You know, I'd been in the road with bands and played rhythm and blues for years. So.
The Big Roll Band.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. The New Animals. Now, that's rather well known, that one.
Well, yeah. Well, The Animals, of course, was one of the world's, you know, was a parallel with the Beatles and the Stones. At that point in the 60s, they had many number ones. I joined a later incarnation when the original group broke up. But, of course, the lead singer was Eric Burdon. And he put together Eric Burdon and the New Animals, which I was a part of.
And I'm wondering, so by the time you actually hooked up with the police, you were in your mid-30s.
I wasn't quite that old.
No?
I was probably about 32.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
was
late, late in
but
the
I
day.
But I was just going to say, but in rock and roll years, you were fully mature, weren't you?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I still luckily looked very young. In fact, you know, looked younger than Stuart and Sting.
I'm wondering, though, what sort of, how you think that might have helped you with this experience, the fact that you'd already been on the road so long.
I think it did, you know, I mean, well, I think that maybe, you know, that I'd had that much experience, that I was a little more grounded than, say, if I'd been 18 and, you know, this phenomenal success that came to the police came to me at 18, I think it would blow you away.
We are talking to Andy Summers. He has a memoir out called One Train Later, and want to remind you that he will be signing books tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble in Greenwich Village. That's 6th Avenue and 8th Street. But we're going to continue this conversation. I'm Catherine Lanfer, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. How did you know that Stewart and Sting were a fit for you?
It was, you know, really not an intellectual decision. It was purely instinctual. I went to see them play. We'd had this period of playing together for 3 weeks for someone else's project that was in Paris when I did that work with them. And there was definitely a connection. You know, they had this other guitarist. I go on at length about this in the book, but a Corsican guitarist who, let's say, was at a much earlier stage of his playing than I was, to be put it kindly. You know, and then eventually, you know, I'd finished this thing that I had to do with him, and it just seemed so obvious that, you know, I should really be part of this band. I knew Sting wanted it because he was chomping at the bit, because he couldn't really exercise his musical ideas in the framework he was already in. Anyway, you know, Stuart and I met on a train, by sheer coincidence, talked it through, and, you know, without too much further ado, I joined the band.
Hence the title.
Hence the title, where I digressed somewhat philosophically about, well, what if it had been One Train Later and I'd missed that meeting, and maybe Sting would be back in Newcastle, maybe Stuart would be in the Middle East. Who knows what would have happened?
Talk about the isolation that comes with success.
It is isolating, and that's a very good point you make. And I made it to someone recently about playing on stage. Well, what's, you know, they were asking what's it like and all that after all this practicing. And I think, you know, the best performances when you're on stage, you're isolated. You are, you know, lonely with, you know, you're in solitude with a lot of people watching you to see what you're going to, how your brain's going to think out of the solo or whatever it is you're doing. You know, in terms of the, you know, the incredible mega success we went with, and sort of hysteria, actually, of 1982-83. You know, I think an important thing was to keep your sense of self very important, because it would be so easy to be destroyed by this. And
how did you do that?
You know, with the guitar, with having the need to play always, and having to, deliver these killer shows which were expected of us. You have to keep yourself together, you know, and I'm not, you know, going to say that we didn't sort of enjoy the what we had created.
But I wish people could see your smile.
Yeah. I know. People ask me about how the hell do you survive this? Why are you still here? And I go, I don't know. I don't know why, because, you know, I haven't lived a life on the straight and narrow at all. I seem to be in reasonably good shape. I think it's something to do with parenting or the way you grow up, but there's a still tiny little voice inside you that just saves you from going all the way, you know, mm-hmm. through all the crazy things that you obviously get involved in.
You've met some amazing people in your career. Mm-hmm. Talk about Eric Clapton.
Clapton, of course, well, I mean, he's a contemporary of mine. We sort of mm-hmm. started together at the same time in different bands, but, you know, we became quite good friends for a while. We used to hang out. We were always playing either in the same night together or the same club, and it was very thrilling to sort of be around and watch him develop his thing, you know, when he developed. It wasn't my thing, as I talk about in the book.
There you was a gave difference. Him a guitar.
Well, yeah.
Okay, you sold him a guitar.
I sold him a guitar. Well, I had a Les Paul before Eric. Eric saw me with it, because we were always playing at the Flamingo. I said, where did you get that, man? I said, well, there's another one up there. It was a 59 Les Paul's worth about $100,000 or $200,000 at this point. I said, oh, they got another one up the road. It's about £80, you know, worth about $100. Because if I'd had a brain, or if I could have looked at my crystal ball, I would have gone back and bought the other one. So he went up and bought it. And, of course, eventually it was stolen. It's a famous story. And then he started to call me relentlessly. I'd sort of moved on to a Fender Telecaster, and I'd pushed the Les Paul under my bed. I thought maybe there was something wrong with it. You know, it didn't seem to work as well. But he was very persistent, and eventually I actually did sell him this guitar, you know, for the incredible sum of £200, which is about 120 more than I'd paid for it. Robert Stigwood moaning about the event. And then I took it over to him, you know, got the money, and then took the guitar over to a place called AdVision, where he was in the middle of recording Fresh Cream.
Mm.
Rest is history. But how about that for a seminal moment?
And you wish you hadn't sold that guitar, I bet.
Damn it. You know.
What contribution do you think you've made to rock guitar?
Well, I think, actually, I mean, you know, this is the point of no modesty. I think I made a huge contribution because, you know, I think the Police, you know, and I have to thank, you know, the band I was in for, you know, bringing all this out of me. It was obviously there. But I think the sound of the guitar, rock guitar, you know, playing or accompanying vocals was changed forever with the guitar sound of the Police. Instead of, like, for instance, you know, mm-hmm. the big bar chords, the distortion, that kind of way of playing, you know, I made a much more elegant kind of way of outlining the chords with a much more a cooler approach to harmony, rather than making it so obviously major or minor in the chord progressions. It made it much hipper, much more late 20th century.
You're going to be playing some concerts in Brazil. Talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, I am. Actually, I've played in Brazil constantly for years, and it's my sort of second country now. I have a lot of friends there. But I'm going down there actually in the end of November, last 10 days of November, to play with Roberto Menescal, who is one of the great Brazilian legends. He's written many songs that are like anthems in Brazil. He's an older guy. He's probably about 70 now, but an incredible harmonic arranger. Anyway, we're going to go down and do a few concerts in Sao Paulo. I'm really looking forward to it.
Now, we only have about a minute left, and mm-hmm. I'm so sorry about that. Mm-hmm. But I have to say that in your book, it's almost as if you wrote two intertwining love stories, one with your wife and one with your guitar. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering just what impact the two have had on each other.
Well, I mean, you know, being a guitarist, which is a very obsessive thing to be, very obsessive instrument, and being married, it don't necessarily go together. We've worked it out. You know, I mean, my wife is a very smart person. I mean, she did have this good sense to divorce me in the middle of the whole police hoo-ha, but also had the good sense to give me a second chance. And 4.5 years later, we got back together, you know, when sort of the real mayhem had died down, and we're still together.
Andy Summers, I'm so sorry that we've run out of time. Have a great time
with
your book.
Great talking to you. Thank you.
A reminder, of course, Andy Summers will be giving a talk and signing books tomorrow at 7 at the Barnes & Noble in Greenwich Village. That's 6th Avenue and 8th Street. I'm Catherine Lanfer, sitting in for Leonard Lopate.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.